It's really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are at 12:12 on this Monday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline Studio, and I am happy to be back with all of you. There was a long break this time, and but I miss talking to everyone over the noon hour, especially during the holiday period. So the folks from Chicago Inno are here. We'll talk to them in just a couple of minutes. Later in the program, we'll talk to Matt Harvey, who wrote a piece in The Reader. You know, it was in 2013, I think it was, that the Chicago public school system shut down 50 schools. Well, one of those schools was a school that Matt Harvey went to, and he talks about graduating from it, being the last graduating class from the school, and then going back to Stewart Elementary recently to see the high-end apartments that are there now. So we'll talk to him a little bit about the transformation of a building that was very important to him and what it means to the neighborhood where it sits. That's some of what's coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We always start on Mondays with the folks from Chicago Inno. Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are in the studio. Welcome to both of you. Nice to see you.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
It's been a long time since all three of us were together. I think we've sort of done it sporadically for a while.
Oh, nice to be back in the studio.
Okay, so you guys had just posted a story about Motorola Solutions. Catherine, you wrote this story. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I'm reading it and I'm thinking this is what gives the conspiracy or the you know, privacy people real pause. Motorola is buying this company that has been what? Taking pictures of my license plate? Is that what they're doing?
Basically, so Motorola Solutions, you know, based here, they acquired this Texas company called Voss International Holdings, and they make artificial intelligence and kind of machine learning powered software, you know, that takes photos of cameras. I mean, that takes right. photos of license plates and stores it in a database that they then sell to, you know, law enforcement agencies so that they can better track down missing people or, you know, solve crimes when they're looking for.
But they create a database short of me before I commit my crime, right? So they're collecting pictures of licenses all the time now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know where they get those pictures from?
So from what I understand, they're kind of, you know, cameras kind of around on, you know, that they're getting this data from streetlight right. cameras, things like that.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right, the way Motorola has kind of evolved as a business. So it's really primarily one of its main functions is providing communications equipment to law enforcement. So you think about a lot of the radios that police officers use. If you look up close, a lot of them say Motorola right across the front, right?
Right,
so this is just kind of the next evolution of the type of technology that Motorola is providing law enforcement. So you'd imagine if a car has been stolen, that law enforcement can use this technology to sort of quickly identify the license plate of a stolen vehicle. So when the technology is used as it's intended, I think it works really well.
So it would be more, Catherine, like they're looking for, do they have access to the cameras or are they sitting on a database of plates, right? So if a car is stolen, then they can say, we're looking for this plate. They would activate sort of their cameras or the cameras in their network to help locate the car?
Yes. Okay. From what I understand, yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, entirely sure, but
so you'd imagine that they're plugging into all the kinds of cameras that the police are using to find, you know, to right. locate crime sort of as they happen.
The cameras that are out there now.
Somebody
already
gets mugged on State Street, you know, there's a camera outside that's picking that up, right? So they're going to use that, but to automatically identify license plates.
Okay. All right. So there's that. And as you said, it signals not a change, but a reinforcement sort of in the new Motorola.
Exactly. And what types of tech equipment they're going to be able to provide.
All right. The Consumer Electronics Show starts, I think it starts in earnest tomorrow, right?
And that's right.
And this is one of those things, and we're in this time of year where we're sort of force-fed certain events. The auto shows are one. The Consumer Electronics Show is another one. So I kind of, you know, get bored with this stuff pretty quickly because they're everywhere. But you guys wrote a piece, Jim, you wrote a piece about something coming from Kohler, which caught my eye.
Kohler has a whole new line of sort of bathroom and kitchen appliances that they're sort of unveiling at CES this week. And one of their sort of innovations, one of their products is a smart toilet. So, you know, you think about what exactly is a smart toilet. Well, it can work with Alexa. So it's got built-in speakers where you can talk to Alexa while you are using the toilet.
Which keeps you off the phone.
Exactly.
Apparently, so you're not talking to your friends and neighbors.
Right.
So, and then you can check the weather, play music or whatever.
Exactly.
It has mood lighting.
It's got lighting on it, so if you're trying to find it in the dark, for example, you can see it. It's got an automatic opening and closing lid, so as you approach the smart toilet, it's called the Numi 2.0, so the toilet lid will open as you approach it and close as you are finished.
Is this the sort of thing that people are going to actually buy?
So I think that there is a very small market, but the people who are going to do this are people who are very interested and excited about bringing the Internet of Things to their entire house, whether it's your doorbell, whether it's your sort of smart television. Now you want a smart bathroom suite too, and so they have kind of Alexa equipped showers as well, where you have a Alexa speaker in your shower to ask the weather or other kind of questions you have too.
So I'm reading your story and thinking about this because it was the shower thing that sort of jumped out at me. It's like, well, it seems like sometimes now we're creating conveniences in areas that weren't inconvenient. You know, it's not that hard to turn on a shower. Now, maybe you could set it for a specific temperature or things like that. But I just wonder if some of these things that are coming out are sort of, I'm not sure the way to put it, but are precursors of things that are going to be bigger or more important.
How connected are we going to be? And you know, the IoT, this Internet of Things, you know, how much of our life is going to be connected to the internet? And eventually, you know, you'd imagine a future where you're being able to, you know, use your voice to ask Alexa or ask your Google Home questions no matter where you are, and you're not tied to a specific device, you're not tied to your phone.
Right, costs and the technology to turn on my shower, I think that's creating a convenience where we didn't really need one.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I actually agree with you. And I think that it's more than just the ability to turn on your shower. It's to be able to have really like a voice search box anywhere you need
house-wide,
it. Right? So yeah, being able to sort of like get your questions answered, figure out the weather, anything that you would kind of ask Alexa that's sitting in your living room, but doing it in really any room of your home.
All right, that's Jim Dahlke. Catherine Davis are here as well. And we're going to take a break and come back and talk about a couple of food startups in the area. Catherine, you wrote a story about this. It's the business called Second Kitchen, which I think this is kind of another example. It's not altogether an old business with a new twist. I guess it is a new twist, but this sort of thing has probably been happening for a long time, but now technology's behind it. Tell me about Second Kitchen.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm sure we've all had that experience where we're, you know, at a bar or a brewery and you get hungry and you realize this bar doesn't serve any food. So your options are, you know, stay and starve or leave and find some food, right?
It used to be they would have a tombstone pizza oven and you would have a tombstone pizza or nothing. Right. So now, so.
Yeah. And so Second Kitchen's whole business model is to, you know, connect these businesses without kitchens to nearby restaurants. So what they do is they allow them to, you know, pick a nearby restaurant, usually within 5 minutes of the place, so that delivery time isn't too long. And, you know, the brewery, the bar can kind of create their own custom menu based on what's available from this restaurant.
And so it works for the restaurant because they have now a second client base, maybe 500 yards away or so. It works for the bar because people are going to stay there and eat rather than go
exactly
to the restaurant or somewhere else. Who pays for this?
So the consumers pay for it. They pay a small fee with every order, and then the Second Kitchen also takes a cut from the restaurant.
And so because I know that there was a beer, maybe it was just called beer, I don't know, nearby where I live, and they had all the different menus where you could order, different restaurants would deliver to you. Now, this is different from that, right? And because these are limited to, what, one or two different restaurants?
Exactly, yeah. The businesses are encouraged just to choose, you know, one or two restaurants, and they have to be, I mean, really close by, you know, like a five-minute walk, because otherwise you could just Grubhub something, right?
Right.
You know, like this is supposed to kind of be that alternative.
Well, so that's a good point. Why wouldn't patrons, if they're hungry, Grubhub it or have it delivered that way otherwise?
Because I don't think you're seeing that. You know, I think I go to breweries all the time that don't have kitchens. I don't, and the thought about Grubhub just isn't like on the top of my mind, right? But if there's a menu right in front of me that's been curated of possible options, like it just makes it a lot more accessible. It says, oh, and there's Catherine, there's a kiosks in some of these places too where you can make an order like right at the restaurant.
So
right,
who delivers?
Brewery.
Does the Second Kitchen deliver or does the restaurant deliver?
The restaurant delivers.
Right. So Second Kitchen pretty much is in just the software and the connection and all of that.
Exactly.
All right, there's that. And then, so then I'm interested too in this company Weinster, where it's an online wine cellar, but they have tasting rooms or they have showrooms in the city. Explain that for me, Jim.
That's right. So Weinster been around since 2014, and they are basically an online marketplace for wine. You've seen a few of these pop up, and what they sort of think is they're taking a little bit of a different approach where they're really going sort of direct to consumer, and it's kind of a tricky business regulatory-wise.
Right, because that's not always allowed, is it?
Right. So there's been the traditional model where you have to go from the grower to the wholesaler to the retailer, and so they've created basically a marketplace that's been like approved by regulators to sort of take the middleman out and go right from the grower to the purchaser.
They're taking on some pretty big players if they're doing that,
exactly.
Right? The wholesalers
and
can't
so
be very happy.
And they just raised about $3 million, and one of their investors, Continental Investors, that's kind of their whole thing, is working with startups that have like big regulatory challenges. They've backed Drizzly, which is an on-demand alcohol delivery startup. So kind of an interesting space here. And so, yeah, like you mentioned, that not only do they have this online marketplace, but they also have these showrooms. They have two showrooms in Chicago, appointment only, you come in, and really what the whole idea is to introduce the buyer to these small production wineries.
Are they tasting rooms?
So you can do some tasting and you get introduced. It's kind of like learning a little bit about like a timeshare, right? Where you sit down and have this whole sort of like hour long meeting with these guys, and they really tell you all about the wines. And you know, when you go to a store like Target, for example, you're really looking at a shelf and you're seeing like almost half the wine is being made by like three producers.
Right,
so
right.
What they're really able to do is open up the selection and show you a lot more variety.
Catherine, good idea to you. Does this sound attractive?
I think so. I mean, you know, people are really interested in craft beer, craft coffee, and then, you know, makes sense for craft wine or, you know, finding and exploring wineries that you may not, you know, necessarily be exposed to otherwise.
And then it becomes kind of a wine of the month, right? You get 3 or 4 bottles a month.
So that's a big part of their revenue is they do this wine club. So they do wine by the month. You get you get 3 bottles for, I think, $79.
Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis from Chicago Inno. Check out more at chicagoinno.com. Thanks for coming by, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Making the trek. No more pedway. You got to take a cab out through the rain.
Yeah. But every Monday, I'm happy to take the cab out here.
We'll see you again next week.
All right.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Don Kleppen. Steve Bertrand here. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. All right, it's a running joke in my house that when I take my kids back, not so much anymore, but would take them down to Manteno, where I grew up, you know, we'd get the tour, we'd go by the old houses, we'd go by the places where I went to middle school or elementary school, junior high, I guess we called it at the time, and, you know, they would roll their eyes. I don't know if you do that as well, but imagine if you went back to your school and they turned it into an apartment building. They paved Paradise and put up an apartment building. That's what happened to Matt Harvey, who writes for the Chicago Reader, and went back to look at Stewart Elementary School, a school he graduated from in 2013, which was then closed by Chicago Public Schools. So, Matt Harvey, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so tell me about, first of all, tell me about Stewart Elementary and your experiences there, why it's hold such a special place in your heart?
All right. Well, so I went to Stewart from kindergarten all the way through eighth grade. So obviously a huge chunk of my life I spent inside those walls. I met so many lifelong friends I still have to this day, teachers that I'm still in contact with. And so I had a pretty deep emotional connection there. I loved going there every day. It was almost like a second home to me. I would go there early in the morning before school started. I'd stay after, and I'd participate in after-school programs there. It was, the school just meant a whole lot to me.
You know, I don't want to start with the end, but you conclude your essay or your piece with a few lovely sentences. One of them, here, I won my first award, had my first fight, learned under the tutelage of some of my favorite teachers, and met lifelong friends, which is a very nice sentiment, which I suppose is, if it's not I'm sure it's not universal, but it's the experience that probably a lot of us have at the school where we grew up.
Yeah, definitely. And it was something true of not only like people that I spoke to, like I spoke to a few of my former classmates and other graduates from the school and preparing to write this story, and even people from like different schools that I talked to even after it was written who came to me and told me like that the story resonated with them. And I think that's something that's lost on a lot of citizens when they think about these school closings, that it's not just about, I guess, the school as a educational institution, but these schools very much held very real, like, emotional and spiritual significance to students that went there and teachers that worked there.
Well, I'm going to challenge you a little bit, Matt, because the city, Mayor Emanuel, closed 50 schools in all that year. 50 communities certainly suffered an uprooting, moved to different schools. But, you know, the place where I went to kindergarten and first grade is torn down, or my second and third grade schoolroom is torn down and is a park now. I mean, things change too, and I don't know if that could be part of the wound, the fact that your school building is always going to be remaining your school building.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. I know that things definitely change, but I guess the big issue is that is the way in which they do. It's the fact that the school wasn't turned into a park or somewhere where, you know, it could be repurposed for the use of children or for the community, for the betterment of the community. It was turned into something that is largely inaccessible to not only the students that formerly went there, but the people that currently live in that community.
So you went back to your school. You went back to Stewart Elementary, and it's been made now luxury apartments, right? And that's your point. The fact is that it's no longer serving the community. In fact, the community it served can't afford to go inside anymore.
Definitely. And it's really heartbreaking when I went back there and spoke to some teachers who used to teach there. And one of my former teachers, Ms. Washington, she Michelle Washington, she was a great teacher of mine, and she basically said to me verbatim that she couldn't even imagine, like, ever being able to afford staying there.
Right. And you've looked at the apartments, right? Who's living in there now?
Oh, well, for the most part, they're wealthier, upper middle class, upper class, Caucasian. I know one of the couples with two young white people. She was a graphic designer, and the other one was a musician. The demographic of people that live there don't closely resemble the demographic of people that worked there or went to school there.
So is
or
it,
even
I'm sorry, go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, or even the demographic of the community at large.
So is your concern that Uptown is changing because of developments like Stewart, or that Stewart is a result of the Uptown changing on its own?
It's more so that Uptown is being, I think it's just being systematically, like, uprooted. The roots of the community are being uprooted. And in a case like Stewart, where people were, the community had a chance to have a say in what they wanted to be done with the property, and it was completely ignored. The community had, and a reporter, Adeshina Emanuel, he did a lot of research on this. But there was a real, like, effort of the community to have the school grounds repurposed in the way that would serve the community, right. And it was completely ignored.
Matt Harvey.
And so that's really what it is.
Matt Harvey writes about Stewart Elementary in The Reader. Check it out. It's a very nicely written piece, Matt, so congratulations on that. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You bet. Good luck to you. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day.
And down goes Fraser.
And by Fraser, I mean Sears. We've been following it for quite a while now, and Sears looks like it has run its course. The approval for CEO Ed Lampert's hedge fund to buy out what was left of Sears has not been approved. The liquidation process will likely begin shortly, since liquidation reps were contacted shortly after the announcement last week. 125 years. It was a good run, but changes always have to come. And changes are coming to Schaumburg's Career Education Corporation. After a long-term debt fraud investigation forcing them to reform their recruiting and enrollment practices. Back in 2015, a $102 million debt relief settlement was reached, and now another settlement was reached, relieving 180,000 students of their debt from the corporation, totaling $493 million in debt. Realize that this is going to go down in history as one of the most impactful aspects of personal and economic burden on American people. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Sponsored here on 720 WGN. On a phone line now is Elise Glink, who, of course, is the brains behind Best Money Moves and thinklink.com. I get her newsletter every Monday morning. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. You know, the news today is that the president is going to travel to the border later this week. I think it's set for Thursday. He wants to, I just saw from one alert that he's requesting, looks like, television time to speak to the country about this the standoff. And so there's that. And you know, not that I was, well, maybe I was downplaying the government shutdown a little bit more than I should have before the holidays, because the idea is that the government workers always get their pay eventually. They get their back pay. So it might be a bit of an inconvenience and not much more than that. But I read a piece today, and, you know, you consider the fact that a quarter of us have really no savings at all, that there's real hardship here when it comes to paying the rent and things like that.
It's true. You know, the Fed found last year in its annual report that 40% of Americans don't have $400 in any sort of cash liquid situation. And so, you know, finding a way to pay the rent when the average rent now in this country is somewhere around $1,700 or $1,800 a month and you don't even have $400 in cash is a real problem. And we also know, and we've talked about this before, that about 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Well, that means when a paycheck is missing, you suddenly are in real trouble. And I think we're starting to see that now that we're in day, I think it's 16 or 17 of the government shutdown. That's a full pay period that people have missed.
It's 800,000 government workers impacted, but they're also, you know, this government depends a lot on government contractors. I don't know if they have the same assurances that they'll eventually get their money if they're not doing their work.
I'm not sure either. And, you know, you do, not only do you have the government workers and you've got all the contractors, and there are millions of government contractors, but you also have other kinds of businesses that depend on the federal government and service them as well. And it can be everything from, you know, grocery stores to what we're seeing landlords or mortgage companies, you know, getting their money, but also, you know, just the little shops around town that depend, you know, for their own livelihood on this. So it's a real serious problem for everybody.
I was reading a piece at CNBC.com, and they talked to a landlord who was going to give her government worker tenants a break, and because of that, she's trying to save money elsewhere, because, right, she depends on that check coming in every month, just like the government workers depend on the checks. Are the mortgage...
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that the mortgage companies have not yet stepped up to say, you know, what they're going to do and if they are or are not going to assess late fees. I think that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are starting to formulate guidance on what they're going to do, but they're not the direct lender. There are companies that service for them, and we'll have to see, you know, what the guidance is coming down. I'd like to just say that I don't think anybody expected this to, you know, go this
right,
length.
Right.
This is a very long shutdown. We're almost at the longest shutdown ever, if not already. Most of the time by now this gets settled because there is such a disruption that's caused. So, for example, over at the IRS, only 12% of IRS workers are actually on duty right now. So the government can take in money, and the IRS is going to open up for business for 2018 tax returns. Usually they open up in the third week. This could delay that, but also your refund check could be delayed. You'll still owe the taxes, but the refunds may not come as expected.
And when it comes to the people trying to make a mortgage payment, if they miss one, not only do they suffer a penalty, right, a late fee, but there can be credit report implications and all sorts of things.
There's no question about it. You know, when you're 30 days late or more, it hits your credit report. And so what we've just had was the first of the year. Mortgage payments typically are due by the first. You may get a grace period until the fifth, but then your payment is due. We're already past that point, so the clock is ticking for those first 30 days. And what we'll have to see is whether the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidance will insist that those late payments be pushed to the credit reports, or if they're going to say, no, don't push that information just yet. We're going to give them yet another 30 days or until the government reopens. I'm waiting to see what that guidance is going to look like.
Is that pretty much Freddie Mac's decision? Do they have the authority to do that?
So Freddie and Fannie have the authority to do a lot of things. What I'm hoping will happen is when you have a natural disaster. So, for example, when we had Houston, the hurricane in Houston, or the ones that hit the Florida area on the eastern border.
Yeah, right.
Right. That they, you know, the guidance that was issued there was you got a moratorium to make your payments until those areas got back up and running. I'm hoping that we're going to see something similar there. But honestly, if this goes to a three-month period, we're going to see a major financial disruption in this country. So I'm hoping that that is not what happens.
That is Elise Glink. Find out more at bestbunnymoves.com and at thinklink.com. Elise, nice talking with you. Thanks very much.
You too, Steve. Thanks so much.